Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Marigold Clothing, making fashion fun since 1989, and Broad Ripple, featuring women's clothing, gifts, and accessories, and committed to customer service. More on Facebook or at marigoldclothing.com. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by eatdrinkindy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink Indy. Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are talking about the James Beard Awards, the Diageo World Class Bartending Competition, Indy's cocktail scene, farmers markets, and the upcoming documentary called Food First. We'll talk with Joshua Gonzalez of Thunderbird in Indianapolis, and we'll check in with lots of farmers market vendors for a preview of what's going on at farmers markets right now. And we'll also hear from filmmaker Hannah Lindgren about her documentary on Indy's local food scene called Food First. And we'll have details on the premiere as well. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. The James Beard Awards are called the Oscars of the food world, and with good reason. The awards gala, which took place in Chicago this past week, is a great event, with food celebrities walking the red carpet and fans trying to spot their favorite chefs. It's a chance for chefs and restaurateurs and writers and the public to come together to honor the best in the business. And I have to say, I love the Beard Awards. It's a terrific evening, and I especially like getting to hear what the winners have to say when they're up on stage. The chefs and restaurateurs, you know, are typically doing their jobs behind the scenes, so it's great to see them in the spotlight at a black tie gala. This year, the awards were in Chicago, like last year and next year, so I just had to attend. As a voting member of the Beard Foundation on the Great Lakes Region Committee, I'm focused mostly on what chefs are doing in our Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, and Michigan region. And even though we didn't have any Indianapolis chefs up for the awards, it was great to see Chicago chef Curtis Duffy of Grace Restaurant win for Best Chef in our Great Lakes region. But now, just because we didn't have a chef in the running for an award doesn't mean we didn't have local chefs in attendance. Like last year, several Indianapolis chefs attended the Beard Awards. Thanks to a generous grant from the Central Indiana Community Foundation and with support from Dig In, four local chefs were able to attend. Jonathan Brooks of Milk Tooth, Alan Sternberg of Cerulean, Greg Hardesty of Recess, and Dean Sample of Meridian. Additionally, Aaron Eds of Ivy Tech Community College and Garden Party Hard Sodas here in Indianapolis was there to represent the city thanks to support from Visit Indy. I felt it was important to get that funding to get some of our chefs there because the Indianapolis food community is right on the cusp of something big. Our food scene is growing, our chefs and restaurants and beverage scenes are getting better, and it won't be long until Indianapolis is represented in those awards. Every time I attend the Beard Awards, I come home even more determined to help our local food scene grow. And I want to thank all of you as well for continuing to support your local chefs and restaurants and programs like Eat Drink Indiana Radio and our Eat Drink Indy website as we keep working to tell the story of Indy's growing food scene. Speaking of awards, local bartender and bar owner Joshua Gonzalez of Thunderbird in Indianapolis is in the running for a very prestigious cocktail award. Just last week, he became one of three Midwest regional competitors to be going to the nationals of the Diageo World Class Competition. Now, this competition tests bartenders in several categories and eventually winnows the field down to one global winner. So next month, Joshua will compete against 14 other regional winners with the goal of representing the U.S. in the worldwide competition. I talked with Joshua this past week, and he explained the details of competing in world class.
It's a global competition, encompasses 50 different countries. We're going through the elimination process to whittle down the competition to 50 bartenders total to compete globally in Miami this year, the first time the competition will be held in the United States. Yeah, so the competition starts nationally with an application process. Several thousand people apply. You have to enter a drink and fill out, I think it's about four essay questions, long format. Those applications are whittled down. People actually make the drinks that are submitted. They have a group that's in charge of that, a group that grades. There's no names attached. They put the grades back together, put the name on it, and then whoever has the highest points goes on to regionals.
What is our region?
We're the Midwest. So Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, what am I missing? Minnesota, and I want to say Missouri, St. Louis, Missouri, is that in there? So what they do is they take 15 per region. So there's five regions, Midwest, Northeast, Southeast, Northwest, Southwest. And 15 per region, top three in each region move on to nationals. So 15 compete in nationals, which is in D.C. this year, the end of June. Whoever wins nationals, only one winner comes out of that and goes on to compete in globals, which is in September in Miami.
So yeah. So we had the regionals.
Regionals were here in Indianapolis.
Here recently, just last week.
Yes, last week, yeah. So it's really cool. They've made it a point to move the regionals around the last couple of years. And they've made a point to move the nationals because it's always in New York. And I think people were kind of griping that let's represent some other cities. So 15 bartenders from all over the Midwest came down to the Alexander on Tuesday, last week, and competed in a long event. I think it started about 9 in the morning. And we finished up about 5:30 that evening.
Oh my goodness! Now tell me what that event entails. It sounds very complicated.
It's complicated, yeah. So it's unlike any other competition. This sort of the world class is sort of the bartenders, like the hardcore guys are going in to compete in a process that is, I don't know the right word, holistic maybe in terms of what. What the judges are looking for. So
it's not just mixing drinks.
It's not just about the cocktail. It's about the technique. It's about your ability to present. It's about your ability to tell a story and interact with the judges in a way that you would like interact with a guest sitting at your bar. So the cocktails are important, but depending on the challenge, they could be the least important aspect of the that particular round. There's three challenges in regionals. Speed round, which requires you to make four drinks in 6 minutes. Dealer's choice, where you go in blind. You actually have cards in front of you. You flip those cards over. The judges give you, and it gives you a base spirit, a flavor profile, and a style.
Give me an example.
So one of the cards, the series of cards that I flipped over, for example, was Bullet Rye, light and refreshing, sparkling. So I have to make a drink and interpreting those keywords. And you have a stock bar behind you and ingredients, fresh fruit, dry goods, herbs, different syrups that you can use that you have at your disposal to create a drink. And then there's a presentation round that is more about, again, your ability to tell a story. And you have to, there's a theme. This year it was an American historical figure. So you had to pick however you want to present. Maybe you're making a drink for that person, or you're presenting as that person, or you're telling a story about that person and relating it to a cocktail that you're making for the judges. So
who did you pick?
I did Billy the Kid, and I did Don Julio's 1942, Super Añejo, aged over 2 years, delicious tequila. I made a little julep out of that with some pineapple demerara, and just told a story about Billy and sort of how his how oftentimes being a rebel, much like Don Julio was in the tequila world, can as perceptions are reality. Like, was he an outlaw? Was he just kind of a freedom fighter? And so we told a story about that and incorporated the tequila into the story.
So you were one of the three people in the regionals who are now going on to nationals.
Yeah.
So what's nationals like?
Even more stressful. when I went in 2014, I was terrified. I was competing against Charles Jolie, who went on to win globals that year.
Absolutely. So no competition.
Yeah. I was competing against Steve Schneider, who's, again, one of the most famous bartenders in the world. Julio Cabrera, one of the most famous bartenders in the world. And Tyson, who actually went on to win the following year. And a bunch of other phenomenal bartenders. Jason Patz, Allison Whitacombe out of Chicago, Carla Rivera out of Miami. It was like a who's who. And I was like this guy from Indy. You know, I knew a lot of these people, but I felt very much out of my element, and ended up doing fairly well. I got my scores back, and I was happy. I was happy to get to nationals. I didn't expect to win. I didn't want to win. I was just glad to be at the table. This year is different, so I feel like going in, I feel very confident, and I feel like my game is experience wise has changed quite a bit, and my style I'm more comfortable with. So I feel pretty confident going into nationals this year, but it's more rigorous. So there's five challenges in nationals as opposed to three. It's a 2-day event, and you're being judged by the leaders in the industry, and that's very intimidating to have sitting across from you. You know, Julie Reiner, who owns some of the best bars in New York, Steve Olson, who you know owns Dal Maguey Mezcal, and just phenomenal bartenders and people that you know, it'd be like sitting across from you know, Charlie Trotter or something like that, from a chef, and having these people judging you. There's no barometer, because you can't see anybody else compete.
Oh, you don't see anybody else's anything?
You don't see anybody else's anything. You go into the room, they call you in, you do your thing, they call the next person. So it's really you competing against yourself.
You practice?
I practiced a lot this time, yeah. I did the speed round. I worked through that like probably 30 times, just trying to get my muscle memory where it needed to be and really work through in my head how I wanted to build around. So the speed round's fun, and that's the one everybody wants to win. You have 6 minutes to make 4 drinks. At nationals, you have 8 minutes to make 6 drinks. That's a lot of time. If I was working in the bar at volume, 4 drinks in 6 minutes is easy. I could have 4 drinks out in 3.
Really? Okay. So it gives me an idea of how long it takes.
Yeah, but in the competition, you want to actually sort of utilize the time, make the time your ally, and really tell a story about the cocktails that you're making for the judges.
Yeah, because you're not just making them. You're talking this whole time, too.
Yeah, so finishing in 2 minutes doesn't get you any more points than finishing in 5 minutes, 59 seconds. It's really about how you're engaging the judges, how you're building the round. So, and the round building is important. So you want to do it in a way that minimizes bottle touches, that's minimizing effort, and but again, still bartending. And not just putting your head down and making the drinks as fast as you can.
It must be nerve-wracking.
Yeah, it's terrifying. It's terrifying. That was the first challenge that I had to do, and I was very nervous going in. I felt confident in my ability to put the drinks out in the time. But, you know, you get up there, and there's the judges. There was a couple, like, some media people and some brand reps, and everybody's watching. And that was... I was glad to do that one first and kind of get the nerves out and come away feeling good about it. And then Dealer's Choice, I was not nervous about at all. I went in there and felt very confident in what the drinks I had made, and finished with like 5 minutes to spare. So that was fun. The presentation, again, I felt like I didn't do my best, but I ended up placing top three in all the rounds. So it was fun.
So now, there are three people from that competition going on to the nationals, right?
Yes. Igor out of Chicago, he works at a place called Untitled, really phenomenal whiskey bar downtown Chicago. And a gentleman named Giancarlo out of Ann Arbor, Michigan, a place called The Last Word, who actually I competed with at nationals 2 years ago. He was there with me as well. He's phenomenal.
So we'll be rooting for you then in June, right?
In June in D.C., yeah. And I'm not making any bones about it. I'm going to try to win nationals this year. I'd really love to snag that national title this year.
We've been talking with Joshua Gonzalez of Thunderbird in Indianapolis about the upcoming nationals in the Diageo World Class Bartending Competition. We'll be back with more from Joshua on Indy's growing cocktail scene here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. This is Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio talking cocktails with Thunderbird owner Joshua Gonzalez. Now, Joshua is among competitors for the national title in the Diageo World Class Bartending Competition next month, but I also sat down with Joshua recently to hear about Indy's growing cocktail scene. We talked about where things have been, where we're going, and what you can expect down the road.
The changes have been huge. You know, obviously Ball and Biscuit was the first to come out, and Zach with what he was doing there. I think Libertine, we opened maybe a year after Ball and Biscuit mm-hmm. did. And sort of a different style of drink making at Libertine. But then you sort of saw this, like, great diaspora occurring, and with Michael going to Platt, Michael Gray, mm-hmm. and doing his thing at Platt 99. You know, I went to Ball and Biscuit for a while and then opened Thunderbird. Devin coming here from Platt. You know, the Spoken Steel guys are doing cool stuff now. Adam Hayden, when he was down over at Bar Rev. There's just a lot of, you know, I think the thing that has occurred in the last 5 years, if you're opening a restaurant, you have to have a cocktail program now, you know.
Oh, no, that is interesting, and that is a change, isn't it?
That's a big change. You know, before you didn't need that. You know, beer and wine was good enough. If you had some spirits, cool. You might have a Manhattan that you were making poorly and, you know, 15 different martinis. But now it's, you know, now I think guests expect at least some form of a cocktail list, you know, six drinks that are done well. I think that's been one big step, is that, you know, everybody anticipates that. Along with that comes, you know, where do you find the talent? You know, and that's, I think that's a problem nationally, anywhere you go.
Oh, it is. It's across the board. Mm-hmm.
There's bars and restaurants popping up like, you know, wildflowers everywhere, and just not a lot of people to fill those holes. I think the change that has occurred is you started to see bartenders becoming more aware of opportunities available to sort of learn. So the Southern Wine and Spirits Academy, I think that's great. This last academy those guys were phenomenal. Yeah, it was huge, and they're very, very in tune and very excited. I teach a course. I've taught it since the first academy or the second academy. I teach the mixology portion, and I've really fine-tuned that down to a very interesting component in how people look at bartending. And so I think when you have these bartenders kind of running through and getting excited, you see places like the Alley Cat, you know, juicing fresh. Which is awesome. Like, I love that. I was talking to their bartenders the other day, and they're like, yeah, we juice fresh, you know. They have some guys that are doing, like, really nice classic cocktails. That's wonderful to see that culture change, because there's just little things that any bar can do to up their program by just a couple notches and give the guest a much better experience drink-wise that don't really cost anything.
Now, have you noticed changes in the consumer as well?
People my age, I'm almost 40, tend to have a really contentious relationship with millennials. I love them. They want to consume at a higher level. They come in with a lot of knowledge already, just because they've grown up with Google, so they can look something up if they have a question. So they come in fairly well educated, and they want to experience that, right? Like, that Instagram culture of, like, look where I am, look what I'm doing. You know, they take pictures of the drinks, take pictures of the food, take pictures of where they are, you know, sort of showcasing the experience. It's interesting that packaged liquor sales are down over the course of the last 3 years, And it's that segment of the population, that younger, you know, 30 under, they don't buy booze at a liquor store, right? They're going out for an experience. So I love it. I think the consumer has changed dramatically, especially that younger segment, because they come in, they ask for mezcal. You know, they know what it is. They want cool rums. They want interesting bourbons. They want a quality old fashioned. They know what an old fashioned should be. And you know, if you're putting a muddled cherry, like, what are you doing? You know, that's not an old fashioned.
So they will ask you questions about it.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. You know, like, hey, how do you make this? Or, you know, what's your daiquiri like? And I think that's phenomenal. That's great.
So it's kind of fun to see the consumer kind of come along with the cocktail culture.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. You know, and that's all part of that, you know, food network sort of, this, I don't know if it's a democratization of food maybe in some way. I don't know what you'd call it, but this interest in a higher, or an interest in eating and drinking in a different way than I did when I was their age.
It may be more knowledgeable, like you said.
Oh yeah, totally knowledgeable. And then, you know, when I was, you know, 25, I wasn't seeking out, actually, those opportunities for me to do that weren't there.
Those bars weren't here.
No, there was any bars like that. You know, you went out, you drank rum and cokes or Jack and Diets, and you know, drank, you know, whatever light beer was on draft. That's just what you did, and you ate at a chain restaurant on a Friday night. You know, it was usually a burger and fries, or a chicken parmesan, something. You know, and those you know, the wealth of and niche restaurants didn't exist. So to have that now is really exciting, especially for young people, because there's all these different types of experiences they can have. So they can come to Thunderbird, get a really phenomenal cocktail, have a nice meal, or they can go, you know, up the street to or across the street to Pioneer, get a really cool Belgian beer and have a really nice meal. So, you know, these little niches that have opened up in the city are really phenomenal.
There's so many more options, you know?
Of options, yeah.
And, you know, I don't know when it started, but it kind of coincided with the rise of the cocktail bars.
Yeah, and I think those cocktail bars coincided with the rise of the chef-driven restaurant. Right.
So I think it kind of coexisted. So sometime in the last 5 to 8 years, yeah, we saw a real change.
Yeah, and I think you know, you got to give credit to guys like Neil Brown and Greg Hardesty, Regina, Micah, mm-hmm, that were, you know, taking a chance on concepts that were pretty progressive at the time. I mean, if you look at Libertine 5 years ago, that was a big change in how people were drinking in the city. Ed taking a chance at black market and rum-driven cocktails, like, why would you do that, you know, 4 years ago? It's crazy.
So those are the kind of things that weren't there when you were 25. There wasn't a rum program at a bar that you would go to.
No. I mean, the only rum I knew was, you know, Captain Morgan. So, yeah, the consumer's more knowledgeable. And I think too, the interesting thing about Indy is, we all kind of came from a similar place. You know, if you look at, like, sort of Libertine was this nesting ground for a lot of bartenders that went off and did their own thing. And now we're at a point where the bartenders working for those guys are about ready to go do their own thing, you know. So it'd be interesting to see in a couple of years, guys, like, you know, what's Devin going to be doing? What's Puck going to be doing? You know, what's Toscano going to be doing? Adam Hayden, like, is he going to open a place? You know, there's all these people out there that have opportunities to grow and add, you know, a new layer of restaurants and projects to the city that... It's cool. Yeah, those little jumping off points are interesting.
So do you see any changes coming down the road?
But the cocktail bar, I think, is going to change a little bit. I think you'll start the next few that open that are more like us, that are cocktail driven. I think you'll see a greater focus on consumer experience in terms of, like, they just want to have a good time. So I wouldn't be surprised if you saw a place open up that was, you know, a little bit more like a hybrid of, say, maybe Brass Ring and Thunderbird, you know, a little bit more neighborhoody. Maybe there's a smaller amount of cocktails that are still executed well, but a little bit more again, that neighborhood feel where anybody can come in, get a, you know, a Bud Light or get something cool, you know, like Holiday in New York, for example. You know, they've got really good, really good drinks, but most people are in there drinking, you know, crappy beer and doing shots. But you can have a really fun experience with the cocktails as well. So I think you'll start to see that sort of these bars popping up that are more entertainment driven that have cocktails as opposed to being cocktail forward.
Do you think we got a little too serious with the cocktails?
Everybody did. That was a national thing. And, you know, you see that recoil start to happen several years ago where bartenders are like, man, this has gotten crazy. Let's just have a good time. And I think we do that here, too, at Thunderbird. You know, you come here on a Friday night, it's packed, three deep. People are crushing zombie dusts or crushing old fashions. You know, we sell, do 500 drinks on a Friday of just cocktails. So, you know, that culture's there. People want to experience that. And if you give it to them in a way and you package it in a way that's not pretentious and it's fun, it makes for a more enjoyable experience.
We've been talking cocktails with Thunderbird owner Joshua Gonzalez. The bar is located at 1127 Shelby Street in Fountain Square. And for more information, go to thunderbirdindy.com. This time of year, but not just because it's Mother's Day weekend and all, but because it's time for the outdoor farmers markets to start. In fact, today is opening day for lots of outdoor markets in and around Indianapolis. The Broadripple Farmers Market, the Carmel Farmers Market, the brand new Garfield Park Farmers Market, they all kick off May 7th for the summer season. But the Wednesday Farmers Market at the Indianapolis City Market launched its season this past week, and I stopped by to see what was new. I talked with lots of vendors, and here is a taste of what you'll find early in the season, starting with some super sweet cherry tomatoes from Eric Simo of Southern Crossroads Garden Center in Columbus.
I've been growing in my greenhouse since October, so we've had them for the winter markets. We've done Bloomington and then Downtown City Market.
Yeah?
Yes, ma'am.
What kind are they?
These two particular are Sun Golds and Lemon Drops.
Been popular?
Very. What I do is I have a mixture. We're putting in 9 different types of tomatoes into that mixture to come up with our baskets.
We also talked with David Rose of Southern Indiana Microgreens.
We grow a wide variety of microgreens. If you're not familiar with microgreens, it's the phase of growing past germination but before baby. At the microgreen growing phase, they're most intense with flavor and nutrition up to 50 times. So, for instance, broccoli, I use it as an example because it's the most intense. It's got sulforaphane in it, which is a cancer-fighting agent. And so if a person wants to get the benefits of that without eating a whole lot of broccoli, they can eat the microgreens. It's 50 times more dense, which is also reflected in the flavor as well.
Have you noticed a lot of interest in microgreens lately?
Yes, lots of interest. I think what kept microgreens at bay in Indiana was the price point. That we had to come in from other states, and the cold chip pack price was just a little bit too much out of chefs. And now that we're seeing a surge of microgreen growers, it's really nice because local chefs can now get local produce at an affordable price, which helps out a lot.
You'll also find lots of prepared foods at the market, including a new item, Methusa's egg rolls, Laotian egg rolls from B. Gustin.
It's a homemade pork egg roll. We cut, we wash, we roll everything ourselves. It was done yesterday. We have a refrigerator that keeps everything cool at the temperature, and then it goes from the refrigerator into the fryer and to you guys.
Now, what makes it different than any other egg roll I might have?
Well, I am from Laos. It is Laotian. Methus means grandma in Laotian.
Oh, it does?
So it's my mom's recipe, and it's not a Chinese egg roll. It's not a Filipino egg roll. So when somebody asks me what kind, it's Laotian, and people ask, is that Chinese? Well, no. I don't think you're going to find this anywhere else. So, but, you know, people come back and tell me that these are the best I've ever had.
And I also stopped by the batch number 2 booth to talk mustards with owner Zach Rohn.
This is our first day here at City Market. We're pretty excited to be here because this is one of our favorite markets to be a part of in the city. Mustard business is going well. We have a couple new varieties that we're introducing. We're bringing out a ketchup as well as a ballpark yellow for some of the fans of the other side of the mustard. That's kind of where we're at right now.
Well, very cool. Now, tell me an update on how the mustard business got started.
So, actually, we started about 2 years ago in May, actually 9th. We started as a bratwurst company before Batch 2, and I worked on condiments, and another fellow worked on bratwurst. We ended up, doing separate things, and the whole time I thought, bratwurst are cool, but this mustard thing, nobody else is making it, and nobody else really even knows much about it, even among the cooking people I knew, and everybody was asking me, well, how do you make mustard? And so I figured that there was kind of maybe a market for that.
You'll also find baked goods at the market as well, including gluten-free treats.
I'm Lydia Armstrong, and I'm with Gluten Free Creations, and I have all gluten-free products and also some paleo lines. So I do sweetbreads, yeast breads, cookies, pies, cakes, everything you could think of that you would eat as a gluten way. You have it in a fantastic gluten-free way.
And it tastes good too, right?
Absolutely. I wouldn't sell it if it didn't taste good. So.
Now, there's been such an explosion of interest and need for gluten-free stuff. Have you seen the response from the markets?
Absolutely. Yeah. And with more and more people finding their allergies or sensitivities to gluten or even other things as dairy and eggs, that I can, I see that as an increase. So I'm able to help them out and offer other opportunities as vegan and dairy-free. So
that's right. So there's been a considerable interest in vegan cooking as well.
As well, yes.
So it's been a good day. I know we had kind of a bad start to the day. Is it ending well at least?
It's starting to pick up, so it's going really well.
But if you're looking for heat instead of sweets, you'll find that too. Just look for the hot sauce at Dale and Jacob Red Wine's booth of Red Wine Family Farms.
We grow the peppers locally grown. They get aged in white vinegar, and my son turns them into hot sauce. They're just peppers and vinegar. There's no additives to them.
Oh, my goodness. Are they very popular?
Very popular. The hotter stuff and more of a novelty item, but some people eat it. I don't myself. I'm kind of a wimp when it comes to that kind of stuff, but it's been very popular.
Now, what is the hottest one?
The hottest one officially is the Carolina Reaper. Guinness Book of World Records recognizes it as the hottest pepper in the world, based on Scoville heat units.
Oh my gosh. And people buy it and they like that?
People buy it. Some eat it, some, buy it because it is the hottest thing in the world. Eat your own.
So you're Jacob, right? Yes. You make the hot sauces? Why hot sauces?
Well, we started making them about, 15 years ago because I couldn't find a hot sauce that had both flavor and heat. It was either one or the other, and it also had salt or sugar in it. So I made one that didn't have either. And we were growing the peppers already, so, we had the ingredients we needed. And then from there, I got requests, and people wanted different types, so that grew to all the ones we have now.
And so you grow them all, even the Carolina Reaper?
We are growing them, yes. We'll have them fresh probably about middle of August, beginning of September.
Wow. Now, is there a lot of interest in the hot sauces? It seems to be a category that's exploded lately.
Oh, yes, yeah. People love hot sauce.
Now, do you like it yourself?
I used to. I burned myself out on it. My body doesn't handle it too well anymore because I found one I really liked and I used it on everything.
Oh, no.
So I still can indulge every now and again, but I know my limits. Yeah, I didn't when I was younger.
Inside the City Market, you'll also find vendors staffing a booth with 4 more farmers market products. Dee Alderman of Graham's Jams filled me in on this new stand.
The City Market is trying a pilot program for this stand that used to be all produce. And they've brought in our jam. We have a nut butter. She makes everything with almonds. We have a honey blend. It's amazing. You have to go taste it. And then we have some microgreens and they're going to try the 4 of us in here to see how it works throughout the summer. And then if it works well, they may make it permanent. So it's going to be fun.
Have you had a lot of good response?
We have, actually. We have. And even when it rained, everybody came in, so it made it better. But it's been great because being right here by the front door, it kind of we're separated from the market a bit, but yet we're not. So it's working out really well.
And we also talked with Ashley Haynes of Revival Foods.
We make stone ground almond butter. We make it all downtown from scratch using simple, pure ingredients. And this is our first time at the downtown farmers market, and we're inside City Market, which has been really exciting. There's been so many people coming through and trying almond butter for the first time even, that it's just been really neat to get to meet them and to introduce them to Revival and what we're doing.
Well, tell me just a little bit about your product line.
Okay. So we have four core flavors. We have classic, which is like a regular. It's most similar to what people recognize as like a peanut butter. We have super spread, which has omega-3 pack superfoods in it. A cocoa love, which is a chocolate and a shredded coconut, and that's a big favorite. And then chai time, which tastes like a spoonful of chai tea. So if you're a chai tea lover, it tastes like you're eating your chai tea.
We've been talking with vendors at the Original Farmers Market at the Indianapolis City Market, which runs every Wednesday from 9:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. on Market Street in downtown Indianapolis. Look for more information at indycm.com. Also at the Original Farmers Market at the Indianapolis City Market, you'll likely spot Chelsea Marburger at her Project Purse booth. As the former director of civic engagement at the City Market, Chelsea is a familiar face at the Farmers Market, so we also chatted with her to find out more about Project Purse.
What we do is kind of take peer-to-peer selling and turn it into peer-to-peer giving. So instead of your Tupperware parties, your Mary Kay, your Arbonne, your 31 purse parties, we do reverse purse parties. Every woman brings a bag, a gently used purse, and then our organization provides all of the toiletries and beauty products, et cetera, to pack them with.
So you fill them up?
Yes, we fill them up, and then we donate them to shelters, IPS, schools, churches, outreach teams. Horizon House actually uses them when they go out into the streets to talk to people. It's just kind of a good tool, like a show of faith, just kind of an olive branch. But each purse also contains a handwritten card. We had a grant from the 100th running committee, and so we had these cards made.
Oh, 500 theme.
Yes. So we're trying to collect 500 purses, 500 products in from May 4th to May 18th in celebration of the Indianapolis 500. So each purse receives a handwritten card as well. So it's from a woman to a woman, positive words, words of affirmation, encouragement, etc.
So you've kicked off, yes, 500 purses.
Yes, and we have probably 25 in there right now, which is great. So today is a great day here at the market now that it's finally sunny. And then we have a collection. If you get on our website, which is projectpurseindy.org, we have an interactive map that shows all of the sites throughout the city. I mean, as far south as Franklin, as far north as Carmel, east and west, all of the different sites that you can donate at.
Tell me how you came up with the concept.
It came from two things. One, all of the invites to stuff that I don't want to go to, and it having to be an excuse to get the girls together. I don't need to spend money to get the girls together. Sometimes the girls want to get together and go to a yoga class or not spend money on stuff I don't need. But it was also this picture that people kept sharing on Facebook over and over again that had a purse with a bunch of stuff in it, and it said, if you want to make a homeless woman's day, keep a care package in your car and give it to the next homeless woman you see. And it just kind of went viral for like 2 weeks around Thanksgiving, naturally. And I got tired of seeing it and no one actually doing anything. So, I mean, me and all my infinite, as you know, Jolene, free time, decided that I needed something else to do. And I bought projectpurseindy.com and .org, and I made a website overnight, and it hasn't really stopped since. Yeah. So we have fantastic community partners too. I mean, Sun King, the girls from Just Pop In, First Financial. We're going to be at the Indy 11 game this weekend. So that'll be fun. It's a puppy themed one too. So there'll be puppies. But we're collecting purses and products there too.
We've been talking with Chelsea Marburger of Project Purse, which you'll see at the Farmers Market at the Indianapolis City Market. For more information, check out projectpurseindy.com. It is such an exciting time to be covering local food in Indiana. We talk to so many great people here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, and I'm happy to say that I'll be part of a panel discussion on local food at the premiere of Food First, a documentary by local filmmaker Hannah Lindgren. The premiere will take place June 11th at Tyner Pond Farm near Greenfield, Indiana. Tickets are $10 each and are available at eventbrite.com. I talked recently with filmmaker Hannah Lindgren about the documentary and why she wanted to tell the story of Indy's local food scene.
Food First is a feature-length documentary film about Indy's food story. And that's all facets of the food story in Indy, from access and our food desert problems that we have, like a lot of cities our size, all the way up to the fact that we have just an amazing amount of local restaurants with some fantastic food.
Now, how did you come to the idea to do this? You know, what was the motivation for doing a documentary?
I have a lot of personal motivation for doing this film. I, about 6 years ago, got pretty sick, and it just turned out that all of it was related to my digestive system. And so once we found out that I had a bunch of intolerances and I had to completely change my diet and my whole way of thinking about food, slowly my whole outlook on food changed. And
how so? How did it change?
Well, I just became a lot more conscious of what I was putting into my body. Before, you know, I just focused on, oh, what do I enjoy eating, or what's fast and convenient, or what is my mom cooking for me? but then when I, you know, especially when I graduated college and it was entirely my own choice, I had to really, you know, be choosy about, am I going to buy organic or conventional? What is the difference? I had to educate myself. Am I going to try and grow my own? I ended up, you know, I have a huge garden. So I just got a lot of education out of it. And a lot of that came through just the filming process and listening to people while we were interviewing them.
How did the filming process start? Where did you begin the story about what's going on in Indianapolis?
Well, I had been kind of toying with doing a film about my own story and just kind of my own trying to figure out how to eat. But then I was introduced to Wendell Fowler, who's a chef and a speaker here. And then he told me, oh, you should meet Audrey Barron. She's opening this raw vegan cafe, and it's going to be the first one in Indy. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know what raw vegan was. So I met with Audrey, and that was March of 2014. And then from there, we just decided, okay, we don't know what the complete story is going to be, but Ezra's is compelling. Let's just start following their story. So we filmed all the way through construction to opening, and during that whole process, we got introduced to a lot of different people, because we got introduced to the people who were growing the things that Ezra's was going to use. And after we got introduced to the people who are growing things, then we got introduced to all of the different ways that food is distributed throughout the city, to grocery stores, to restaurants, to, you know, even to your door. So there, it just kind of spread out from there like a web.
Was there anything that was surprising about all these things that you were learning?
The most surprising part was that they are all interconnected. I think a lot of people look at the issues like they're completely separate things. You know, that food deserts is a thing, that people don't have access to food, or that, oh yeah, we have great restaurants, or we have great local grocery stores, but they don't really think about how they're connected, even though, you know, the through line is food. But really, they all rely upon each other in some way, and they all require each other to exist. So it was just really fascinating to see, honestly, the story unfold itself and just show it how it was all interconnected without me even really having to try. So
where are some of the places that you went? You know, what are some of the restaurants or the businesses or the farms that you were filming along the way?
Yeah, so we, for each sort of section or topic in the film, we kind of focused in on one organization or business that we felt was representative of others like it or what was happening in Indy. And that just was because if we tried to focus on too many, it would water down the point. By the time we got introducing what each place was, we would have to move on. So we felt like we should go in depth more with them. So, like, for example, with the education piece and learning about how to, like, a lot of people take raw vegetables and they don't know what to do with it because they might not have that experience of cooking at home. Well, places like Growing Places Indy are doing that. They're teaching kids at a young level how to to cook food and how to do it nutritiously. And then we have Ezra's Enlightened Cafe in Broderick Bowl. Obviously, they're the ones we started with, so they're the restaurant that we focus the most on. We also wanted to have a representative of, you know, vegetarian or vegan versus non. So for the one that we focus on in the growing food section, we focus on Tyner Pond Farm, which is a protein farm in Greenfield. And then we have some other places sprinkled in there, like Good Earth and Pogue's Run, which are two grocery stores we focus on. And we look a little bit at green bean delivery and other sort of alternative ways to get your groceries. We look at community gardens in general, and yeah, that's most of them.
What was the reaction from some of the people that you approached to feature in the documentary? You know, they're busy doing their work. What did they say when you approached them?
Yeah, they're all tremendously busy. That is definitely a common denominator among all of these businesses and organizations. So they were all very gracious in letting us intrude a little bit into their time. Mostly we just said, can we stick a mic on you and follow you around? Can we just come and, you know, you just tell us when you're working and we'll come get it. The only time that we needed to set aside was the interview time, which usually took less than an hour or so. They were gracious enough to give us that time.
Now, are you in the documentary itself?
I am not. No, I decided pretty early on that I wasn't going to be part of it, mostly because there are so many great people in the food story in Indianapolis that there's no reason for me to be in there when you have all these amazing people. And then secondly, it just, you know, everyone's food story is different and how they get to there. And I didn't feel like, even though mine is a common story of people getting sick or, you know, finding that thing that prompts them to make a change, I didn't feel like it needed to be the thing that we talked about. There are a lot of different ways you can get to that point in your life where you want to make a change.
Well, now tell me a little bit about your media company and what you do in, you know, your regular job, right?
Yeah, so I own Deliberate Media, which I started shortly after graduating in 2013. And we are a storytelling company. So we tell short stories for clients that are organizations, businesses, community groups, really anyone who has a story to tell. And we believe that's everyone. but we approach the storytelling and the video from a storytelling angle, from the point of view that the best way to get across what you do or what you sell is through telling your story. That's the most emotionally impactful way to do it. And the best way to do that is through video, in our opinion. So we make short videos. A lot of them are less than 3 minutes, and they'll usually be used online some way. So maybe Facebook advertising or even just put on Facebook or on websites. We do a lot of what we call business trailers. So it's telling a story, but it basically tells the story of your business in a way that's nice, short and sweet, to the point, and people can kind of get a feel for who you are.
Now, tell me a little bit about details of the film, you know, how long it's going to be, when it'll be released, and how people can find out more information.
Yeah, so the film will be a little bit over an hour and 10 minutes, so it's not that long. And the reason why we didn't make it very long is because each of our six initial screenings this summer are going to be followed by a community conversation. And that's because we never created this film as a way to self-promote or as a way to make money. We did the opposite. It was all because, you know, we're passionate about what's happening in Indianapolis, and we believe the story needs to be told. And we believe that the more people hear about it and learn about it, the more they'll be involved and the more changes they'll make or the more they'll participate in the movement. So we want to have these conversations after each screening, where we'll have a panel of experts on the topic and open it up to discussion with the audience. And each screening, depending on who we're partnering with, will be on a different topic covered in the film. There's obviously no way that we could include everything that's going on in Indianapolis in the food scene in this short film. So this is a way to expand upon it within each of those topics. So, for example, our first screening will be at Tyner Pond Farm, and the discussion afterward will focus on growing practices and making growing local economical. And then we're partnering with Eskenazi Health for a screening at Eskenazi Hospital, and theirs is going to be focused on their whole idea of food as preventative medicine, and their Sky Farm and everything. The Sky Farm is included in the film as well. And then Indie Food Council is going to be hosting a screening, and their conversation will be about food as economic development for the city. So, you know, each one, so you can kind of like pick and choose. What do you want to hear even more about afterward? And what conversation do you want to participate in? And that's the screening you should go to so that afterward you can be involved in that.
And the screenings start this summer, right?
Yes. The first screening is June 11th. And then there's three more pretty quick back to back. We're looking at late July for the last two. So it's June and July.
And people can follow you on social media, I assume?
Yes, we are on Facebook mainly. So it's facebook.com/foodfirstfilm. And you can follow us on there. We are currently posting a lot of quotes from the film, so you can kind of get an idea of who's featured and what they're saying and what we're trying to say with the film. So those are pretty shareable images, and we'd appreciate it if you would do that.
We've been talking with filmmaker Hannah Lindgren about the documentary Food First. The premiere of the film will be June 11th at Tyner Pond Farm. For information on the documentary, look for Food First on Facebook, and tickets are available at eventbrite.com. I'm Jolene Katzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning into the show this week, and thanks also to our guests, Joshua Gonzalez of Thunderbird in Indianapolis, Eric Simo of Southern Crossroads Garden Center, David Rose of Southern Indiana Microgreens, B. Gustin of Mathus Egg Rolls, Zach Rohn of Batch Number 2 Mustard, Lydia Armstrong of Gluten Free Creations, Dale and Jacob Redwine of Redwine Family Farms, Dee Alderman of Graham's Jams, Ashley Haynes of Revival Foods, Chelsea Marburger of Project Purse, and Hannah Lindgren of Food First. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio.